Welcome to Feminist History. I want to kick off today's episode by talking a little bit about the first wave of feminism in the United States. This is typically the period of time from the 1848 Seneca Falls Convention that signaled the beginning of the women's suffrage movement, up to the mid-1920s, right after ratification of the 19th Amendment to the American Constitution. When I think back to my public school education, back to when I first started learning about this period of the women's rights movement, I can remember learning about the lives of women like Susan B. Anthony, Lucretia Mott, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. These were all well-educated, middle to upper-class white women who aligned themselves with causes like suffrage, property rights for married women, temperance, and the abolition of American chattel slavery. In fact, the early women's rights movement was inextricably linked with the abolitionist movement, which makes it all the more ironic that there are very few Black women activists widely discussed in the historiography about this time. In fact, I can remember learning about exactly two: Sojourner Truth, for her notable Ain't I a Woman speech, and Harriet Tubman, famous boots on the ground for the Underground Railroad. Why is that? Well, the first underlying reason might be because the women's suffrage movement was designed to win white women the right to vote, not Black women. I know this beyond a shadow of a doubt because exactly no Black women were invited to the Seneca Falls Convention, which kicked off the women's suffrage movement in the United States. So, by design, first wave feminism in the U.S. was about white women's rights. Is it because Black women simply weren't prevalent in the fight for equal rights, universal suffrage, and the abolition of American slavery during this time? Of course they were. Yes, there were roadblocks everywhere designed to silence these voices. But despite extreme racism and discrimination in the United States during the antebellum period, as in before the American Civil War, in the North as well as in the South, there were numerous vibrant communities of free people of color that produced men as well as women activists who attended anti-slavery conventions, debated the pathways forward to a more equitable society, and contributed to the written discourse about the problems of their day. Today, we are going to zero in on one such woman activist and discuss the fascinating life of Mary Shad Carey. Her list of achievements is long and distinguished, but what makes her a perfect subject for season one of Feminist History is she was the first Black woman editor of a newspaper in North America. Today, I'm going to tell you about the adventures and struggles of the first half of her life. There are two major written works about Mary Shad Carey's life that I used as the main sources for this episode. The first is a work from the 1970s called Shad, The Life and Times of Mary Shad Carey, by Jim Bearden and Linda Jean Butler. The second is a magnificent biography by Jane Rhodes called Mary Ann Shad Carey, The Black Press and Protest in the 19th Century. Information about these works, plus the rest of the sources I used for this episode, including links to the digitized copies of the newspapers from the mid-19th century, can be found on my website at darknostalgiaworks.com. Welcome to The Life of Mary Shad Carey, Part 1. On March 23rd, 1849, a letter appeared on the third page of Frederick Douglass's newspaper, The North Star, signed by M.A. Shad. The letter answered a query from Douglass over how to improve the conditions of free Black people in the northern United States. Things were not improving. The country seemed to be barreling in the wrong direction and was on the eve of passing legislation that would endanger the lives of free Black people as well as escaped enslaved people. The author expressed disdain over the previous status quo efforts to eradicate slavery and racism from the United States completely and elevate people of color. Quote, "We have been holding conventions for years. have been assembling together and whining over our differences and afflictions, passing resolutions on resolutions to any extent. But it does really seem that we have made but little progress, considering our resolves. We have put forth few practical efforts to an end. I, as one of the people, see no need for our distinctive meetings if we do not do something. We should do more and talk less. End quote. It's unclear whether or not readers could tell that the author of this letter was a woman, given the androgynous initials M.A., but this letter was the first time Mary Ann Shadd's name appeared in print. She was 25 years old and working as a teacher in Wilmington, Delaware. The letter contained a litany of views and ideas that she would go on to develop and explore in her own published works in the years to come. The last line, "We should do more and talk less," resonates. It foreshadows the rest of her life. Mary Ann Shadd was born and raised to be a doer. On October 9th, 1853, Abraham Shadd and his young wife, Harriet, welcomed the first of their 13 children into the world, a daughter named Mary Ann. The Shadds were better off than most. They were free people of color living in the slave state of Delaware. Their family had settled in Wilmington well before the American Revolution, and Abraham Shadd was a respected landowner with a trade to support his family. He made shoes by day, but it was his extracurricular activities that probably had the biggest impact on his daughter, Mary Ann. Abraham Shadd was a conductor on the Underground Railroad, a sophisticated network of people who helped get enslaved people out of the southern United States and into the North during the antebellum period. Some went as far as Canada. He risked much. As a free black man, Shadd enjoyed quasi-freedom at best in a slave state and would have had no protection under the law if caught ushering slaves to safety. As if that weren't enough, Abraham also started acting as an agent for the abolitionist newspaper, The Liberator, started by famed abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison in the early 1830s. The 30s were a shaky time in the United States over the question of slavery. Nat Turner's rebellion had just struck fear into the hearts of white people everywhere. Roaming bands of so-called slave patrols brutalized the countryside, causing a reactionary abolitionist movement in the North to take hold like never before. The Liberator did not receive a warm welcome, even in Washington, D.C. Jim Bearden and Linda Butler provided an eye-opening example in their Shadd biography. Quote, "The Corporation of Georgetown in Washington, D.C. passed ordinances that forbade free Negroes to take copies of the Liberator from the post office. Legal retribution for those that picked up their copies of the Liberator was 25 lashes and imprisonment, and they just might sell you into slavery if they took a notion." End quote. Needless to say, Abraham Shadd made a bold choice and remained solid in his convictions. He also may have written as a correspondent for Garrison, though we can't confirm that. When Mary Ann Shadd turned 10, Abraham and Harriet made the decision to uproot their family from their ancestral home of nearly five decades and move the family to Westchester, Pennsylvania. This move altered the trajectory of Mary Ann's life. Not only did it immerse her in an environment where she was surrounded by Quakers, who were well known for their anti-slavery, pro-education, and pro-women's rights ideology, she was also now in the vicinity of the elite black community of Philadelphia. In Westchester, Mary Ann had room to grow and develop into a progressive activist. Abraham's work with the Underground Railroad continued in Westchester, and it's largely believed that the Shadds worked closely within a faction of the Underground Railroad with the Darrington family, a well-known Quaker family, specifically a woman named Phoebe, who was likely Mary Ann's schoolteacher. After 6 years of schooling, Mary Ann emerged as an educated, opinionated young woman ready to enact change upon the world. She found her avenue in education. In her biography on Shad, Jane Rhodes put this into perspective when she wrote, quote, "Education was believed to be synonymous with Black liberation since the days of the early Black conventions, and the Black elite were obligated to transmit the riches of their knowledge to the less fortunate," end quote. So, with this philosophy in mind, Marianne Shad left home and embarked on a decade-long teaching career. Little is written or known about Marianne Shad during the decade of the 1840s. A letter from her father has survived, and Jane Rhodes wrote about it in her biography. What's clear from this letter is Marianne did experience some strife and some unhappiness within her teaching career, more than likely stemming from a lack of understanding from her students, and maybe from the pitiful wages and long hours that were typical for Black women teachers of the era. But her father simply expressed support. He told her to come home if she needed to. It's clear that they had a loving and supportive relationship. In 1849, Shad wrote the aforementioned letter to Frederick Douglass, but she also wrote and published a 12-page pamphlet on her views. Per Shirley J. Yee, quote, "In Shad's first published essay, Hints to the Colored People of the North, in 1849, she chastised Blacks for imitating materialism in middle-class whites and encouraged them instead to focus on anti-slavery reform." The themes of Shad's writing from this time focus on social uplift of Black people by casting off these cultural norms that she saw as resulting from the institution of slavery and racism. Marianne posed a broader question with this essay. What have we really gained from all of our hard work as activists? To many, including the Shads, it seemed like the country was regressing on issues of race and slavery. And by 1850, they were unfortunately proved correct. On September 18, 1850, Congress passed the Fugitive Slave Act. It reinforced earlier piecemeal legislation designed to curtail the efforts of self-emancipated enslaved peoples fleeing to northern free states and bolstered the power of slave owners. Aiding a fugitive slave became a federal crime, with hefty penalties of up to $1,000 fines and prison time. The law also awarded slave catchers $5 per person captured, making the slave catching business a lucrative and legitimate trade sanctioned by the United States government. The Fugitive Slave Act was a sobering moment for the free Black population of the northern United States. It signaled a power shift. Everyone now knew exactly where the federal government stood on the issue of slavery. They drew a line in the sand, giving federal power and allyship to slave owners. Now, no matter where an enslaved person ran, be it Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, no state was safe for the fugitive slave. Hell, nowhere was absolutely safe even if you were a free person of color. If you don't believe me, just go read Solomon Northrup's 12 Years a Slave. I'll be releasing a bonus episode where I do a deep dive on the Fugitive Slave Act with Jasmine from the Killing Nostalgia podcast, so look for that sometime next week. By the time the Fugitive Slave Act made headlines, Marianne Shad was installed as a teacher in a primary school in New York City. New York City, in the 1850s, was a hostile place for a free woman of color, but it had a bustling community of anti-slavery leaders. Marianne seemed to come into her own while in the city, making connections and lasting friendships that would become important later on. Jane Rhodes relayed an anecdote from Marianne's time in New York City that I think really helps give you a sense of the woman she had become by her late 20s. An onlooker described Marianne Shad hailing a hansom cab on a busy street. The driver she flagged down was a well-known racist and notorious for refusing to give Black women rides. But Marianne Shad had such a commanding presence that when she raised her hand, this man screeched to a halt so that she could embark and drove her to her destination without further comment. Marianne Shad had confidence as well as conviction. She grew up in a family that nourished these attributes, And it really appears to me that despite facing strife for her race and her gender, she didn't allow herself to be held back by either of these things in her own mind. She was worthy and deserving of respect, and she would take up her own space as an activist within the anti-slavery movement. People of color in the North reacted to the passage of the Fugitive Slave Act in different ways. For some, like those in Frederick Douglass's camp, the United States was their home. They were not going to be driven out. They would stay and fight for their rights as well as the abolition of slavery until the end of their days. For others, though, it strengthened their resolve to immigrate elsewhere, to seek out more equitable arrangements in places like Canada and Mexico, where they would be free from the threat of lurking slave catchers, at least in theory. They were definitely safer than they were in the United States. In the weeks and months following the passage of the Fugitive Slave Act, many escaped enslaved people and freeborn people of color left the United States in mass exodus. As per Jane Rhodes, quote, one newspaper account estimated 3,000 fugitive slaves arrived in Canada within weeks of the Fugitive Slave Act, end quote. The Canadian Encyclopedia estimates that the black population in Canada more than tripled between 1850 and 1860. One estimate said that by February of 1852, between 35,000 and 40,000 black refugees were in Canada. Black men enjoyed full enfranchisement in Canada, unlike the United States, but racism and sexism persisted even north of the border. By late summer of 1851, Mary Ann Shadd was still on the fence about what to do. In September, she traveled north to Toronto, Canada with her father, Abraham, to attend the Great North American Anti-Slavery Convention. This convention turned out to be a defining moment in her life, a catalyst for intense personal change. By the end of the three-day conference, Mary Ann Shadd had become convinced that Canada offered much greater opportunities for people of color than the United States, and she became a staunch proponent for black immigration further north. She also made several acquaintances with many of Canada's foremost anti-slavery leaders, including the president of the convention, the abolitionist and formerly enslaved Kentuckian, Henry Bibb. It was Henry Bibb who actually convinced her to move from New York to Windsor, Ontario, or at least as it was known in those days, to Canada West. Within weeks of the convention, Mary Ann had traveled with Bibb to Canada West and was permanently installed in Windsor. Her family followed her and settled in Canada within the year. The Winston Sandwich area was one of the most popular crossing points for enslaved African Americans because of its proximity to Detroit, Michigan. Windsor is situated on the banks of the Detroit River and a stone's throw away from the Canadian-American border. For many fugitive enslaved people, it was the first place that they could rest in relative safety after fleeing the institution of slavery. A large community formed throughout the 1840s and 1850s, which created a greater need for institutions like churches and schools. Unfortunately, by 1851, Winston still didn't have a school. So, abolitionist Henry Bibb recruited Mary Ann Shadd, a teacher with a spotless record and intense ties to the abolitionist movement in the United States, to start one. Throughout the early months of her residence in Windsor, well-educated and well-spoken Mary Ann Shadd folded right in with the activist community within the area, including her recruiter, Henry Bibb, and his wife, Mary, who lived in the nearby community called Sandwich. The Bibbs were considered respected leaders in the fugitive community, and Henry was internationally known for his anti-slavery lectures at conventions throughout the 1840s, as well as his 1849 memoir, Narrative of the Life and Adventures of Henry Bibb, an American Slave. Born the child of a white Kentucky senator named James Bibb and an enslaved woman named Mildred Jackson, Henry had attempted to escape slavery numerous times in his early years, only to be recaptured. He finally escaped to freedom in the early 1840s and settled in Detroit, Michigan. It is here he met and married a freeborn woman named Mary Miles, who was an educator from New Hampshire, and the couple fled to Sandwich, Canada in the wake of the Fugitive Slave Act. Together, Henry and Mary Bibb started the first long-running black newspaper in Canada called The Voice of the Fugitive. A four-page bi-weekly paper, The Voice of the Fugitive ran from January 1, 1851 to December 16, 1852, then expanded to a weekly edition published until 1854. In his introduction in 1851, on January 1st, he wrote, quote, "We shall advocate the immediate and unconditional abolition of chattel slavery everywhere, but especially on American soil. We shall also persuade, as far as it may be practical, every oppressed person of color in the United States to settle in Canada." Oral history states that Henry and Mary often allowed newly arrived fugitives to stay in their home after they crossed the Canadian border. And by 1851, the Bibbs had helped establish a settlement organization for fugitive slaves in conjunction with white Detroit abolitionists. Per Jim Bearden and Linda Jean Butler, quote, "The Bibbs were, for all intents and purposes, king and queen of the local fugitives," end quote. Initially, Marianne Shad's relationship with them had been warm and conciliatory. The Bibbs shared a lot of the same values with Marianne Shad. They were all champions for the immigration movement, they all believed in the power of education and temperance, and they all worked tirelessly to improve the conditions of people of color in North America. Despite the alignment of their core values, however, this friendship between them soured with a quickness and turned into an epic and ugly feud that would change Marianne's life and career forever. And it all started with the Refugee Home Society. The Refugee Home Society aimed to provide land and resources to newly escaped enslaved people crossing the border into Canada. Here's a rundown of the Society's mission, provided by an 1856 work called The North Side View of Slavery, The Refugee, by Benjamin Drew. Per the Society's constitution, adopted in 1852, quote, "It appears that each family of actual settlers receives 25 acres of land, five of which they receive free of cost, provided they shall, within 3 years of the time of occupancy, clear and cultivate the same. For the remaining 20 acres, they shall pay the primary cost in 9 equal annual payments, free of use, for which they shall receive deeds. This society shall give deeds to none but landless refugees from American slavery, i.e., they do not do business with free people of color, people who were born into freedom in the United States. No person receiving land by gift or purchase from the society shall have the power to transfer the same under 15 years from the time of the purchase gift, as in they cannot sell this land within 15 years of purchasing from the society. All lands becoming vacated by the removal or extinction of the families shall revert back to the executive committee," meaning if the family were to die, the Refugee Home Society would reclaim the land. "No house shall be used for the manufacturing or vending of intoxicating liquors on any lot received from the society," i.e. temperance. The society employed traveling agents to solicit donations from American abolitionists to help aid the fugitives. One such agent was a man named Reverend Charles C. Foote, who solicited thousands of dollars of donations in Detroit, Boston, Philadelphia, and New York for the, quote, "starving and helpless fugitives fleeing the states and arriving in Canada desperate and destitute." This method of obtaining donations was dubbed begging by many in the abolitionist community, and it was a tactic that Mary Ann Shad loathed with her entire being. Shad took major issue with fugitives and people of color being portrayed as starving and helpless. She thought this portrayal was akin to arguments of Southern slaveholders who said that Black people were lost without masters and could not take care of themselves. Now, despite her aversion to begging, however, Mary Ann had to seek outside funding to make her little school in Windsor a reality. She needed to find a grant to support herself and get the school off the ground. And then she intended to keep it going through private funding from parents and students themselves. At least that was her goal. Mary Ann found a potential avenue through the American Missionary Association. Now, per the AMA's self-published history from 1886, quote, "The American Missionary Association was formed in Albany, New York on September 3, 1846, in the early days of organized resistance, religious and political, to the supreme domination of slavery. The AMA had endorsed the Refugee Home Society and decided to bolster their missionary presence in the area as a result. One such missionary in Windsor was a Scottish reverend named Alexander MacArthur. MacArthur was revered among the fugitive community, and after seeing the quality of work that Marianne Shad put forth in her school, he became a close personal ally of hers. He even wrote a recommendation letter to the AMA on her behalf. She applied for a missionary position and funding for her school in the amount of $250. At that point, many of Marianne's students couldn't afford to even pay the meager sums that she was asking, which was pennies on the dollar, to help keep the school going. And she was relying on money from her parents sent from the States to get by. She kept her negotiations with the AMA a secret from her students because she feared that the second that people found out she was receiving outside funding, that parents and students would stop paying even the small amount that they were giving at that time. And she needed every bit that she could get to create the school that she wanted to create. Remember that Marianne's desire was to help create a self-sustaining community. So the fact that she was resorting to applying for AMA funds was contrary to her personal belief system. She had openly criticized the Refugee Home Society for the exact same practice. This left her exposed. Should someone alert the community, it might look like Marianne was double-dipping or taking fees from her students while receiving funds from the American Missionary Association. That could hurt her credibility. The AMA did approve her application, but they only agreed to pay her half of what she estimated her cost would be, $125 for a one-year contract. She started receiving paychecks as an AMA missionary in April of 1852. Now, simultaneously, Shad had taken to writing about the benefits and virtues of immigration to Canada in a 44-page pamphlet titled A Plea for Immigration or Notes on Canada West. Jane Rhodes called Shad's decision to publish this volume the ultimate act of defiance. Not only did Shad write and disseminate her own opinions, free of any collaboration with the male abolitionist leaders in the area, she also went with a white Detroit printer. This was a major slap in the face for Henry Bibb, who happened to be a printer. But it ended up being a huge mistake for her, because that Detroit printer ended up being a massive racist who intentionally disregarded edits that she submitted and published her pamphlet loaded with typos. Regardless, Notes on Canada West added Shad's name to the discourse on the immigration debate. It put her on the map as a free-thinking activist, even if it did come across as biased and conveniently neglected to discuss the hard reality of racism in Canada at the time. It only took a few months for Henry Bibb to find out about the funds Shad received from the AMA. Because the AMA had endorsed the Refugee Home Society, Bibb, of course, had personal friends and contacts within. He published an article in July of 1852 in The Voice of the Fugitive that, on the surface, seemed harmless enough, but it laid out in explicit detail Marianne's funding plans with some highly inaccurate additional details, such as inflated estimates of the funds she was already getting from her students. But this was a really low blow. Marianne had to do serious damage control within the community. She immediately called a meeting at her school and explained the entire situation to the community. And by the end of it, the damage done by Bibb's article was largely undone, much to his dismay. After that, it was a full-on war of the words between the Bibbs and Marianne. Marianne Shad paid a price for her outspokenness. Middle-class Black women were judged just as harshly by the culture of domesticity as white middle-class women were. As in, the woman's place is in the home. How Shad conducted herself as an intellectual activist in the public sphere, unmarried and unstifled by male opinions, shocked a lot of people, including Henry Bibb and Reverend Charles C. Foote, the fundraiser for the Refugee Home Society. Shirley J. Yee underscored how Marianne's views were in direct opposition with Bibb's in the following quote. Quote, Shad's promotion of integration into the dominant society ran contrary to the prevailing Black immigrationist ideas of creating an independent nation that would function separately from white society. So, Marianne Shad created waves with these views. To make matters worse, Shad wrote an anonymous letter detailing her feelings about the Refugee Home Society and sent it to a Canadian publication called The Western Evangelist. It took no time for The Voice of the Fugitive to publish a retort vilifying the writer, who they had instantly identified as Shad. From an 1853 edition of The Voice, they wrote this of the, quote, anonymous scribbler. no one who has become acquainted with the object of the society and who professes to be a friend of the colored man has ever spoken in any other than admiring terms of it, except an insignificant anonymous scribbler in this village who has undertaken to vilify the institution by articles in the Western Evangelist. We suspect who it is, notwithstanding the attempt to conceal the writer's vernacular by parroting two words of foreign idiom. We judge it to be this person, whom we inadvertently placed in the position of a public deceiver by a statement of fact in our columns not long since, and which brought out to public acknowledgement of some secret and underhanded measures. So basically, they're referencing where they called out Marianne Shad for taking funds from the AMA without telling anybody. By fall of 1852, the disagreement between the Shads and the Bibbs over the Refugee Home Society had started drawing notice from more famous abolitionists, notably a man named Reverend Samuel Ringwald Ward. Reverend Ward was a congregational minister, a newspaper editor, an orator, and an agent for the Anti-Slavery Society of Canada. Before he traveled to Windsor in late 1852, he wrote as a correspondent for Bibbs Voice of the Fugitive. And he was an early supporter of the premise behind the Refugee Home Society. After spending time in Windsor in late summer of 1852 and seeing the operations of the Refugee Home Society firsthand, Ward called a meeting at Mary Ann's schoolhouse to hash out the public opinions about the society. He publicly decried the organization and aligned himself with Shad, becoming a useful ally to her in the coming months. He wrote of his opposition to the organization, quote, "I oppose the Refugee Home Society for the following reasons. There is no need for any other land buying or land selling organizations in Canada for fugitives or others than those provided by our laws. In the very neighborhood of Mr. Bibbs' residence, in every township of the county of Essex, wherein he resides, the government has lands quite as good, if not better, than that owned by the Refugee Home Society, for sale at a lower price than the Home Society will sell. And the purchaser can obtain them with equal, if not greater, faculty and hold them by a much better tenure." Shad organized another meeting shortly after, acted as secretary, and was voted to draft a written list of complaints about the Refugee Home Society and send it out to abolitionist news publications in the United States. Bibb immediately published a rebuke in the Voice of the Fugitive. Quote, "There has been some feeble opposition shown to the society in Windsor, only by a set of half-cracked, hot-headed individuals who have the vanity to think that because the society would not show the same favors to those who have been free all their lives that they do the fugitives from slavery, that they could call a meeting to break up the refugees' home." Bibb described a scene of utter chaos in which people came to blows towards the end of the meeting, making them seem primitive and wholly disorganized. The piece was unsurprisingly complimentary of the Refugee Home Society, stating that at the time, 12 worthy settlers had made their homes on the settlements and were employed in raising the trees and converting it into cordwood, which apparently could be sold at 50 cents per cord. He painted a picture of free men toiling on their own land, free of molestation from those who would steal their liberty and their labor. At this point, Shad and Ward decided that there was a desperate need for a paper willing to publish opinions contrary to the Fugitive Voice. They set about creating a publication of their own, but it would take several months for them to get it up and running. Bibb's piece about the Windsor meeting was published in William Lloyd Garrison's The Liberator within weeks, and it kicked off an epic print battle between the two factions. In November of 1852, The Liberator published a long letter in response to Bibb's description of the Windsor meeting, and it's presumed that this was written by Shad. Quote, "As the Voice of the Fugitive has given a description of the Windsor meeting which is not at all true, but which, being copied in anti-slavery papers, is calculated to injure the people here, we are constrained by its course to state the facts in relation to it." End quote. She went on to describe the meeting, the resolutions passed against the Refugee Home Society, and the brief dissension into chaos, during which Henry Bibb jumped up and called the meeting illegal, snatched the resolutions paper, and ran out. They got it back, but Bibb slew the meeting in his newspaper. Shad reported that, quote, "The reason given by the editor to persons who visited him to ask why he had given a false report of the meeting was that it was in his interest to make it look as bad as possible," end quote. The letter also claimed that barrels of clothes sent by charitable organizations in the U.S. were not actually given to fugitives in Canada. Rather, they were left to rot in the cellar of Bibb's home. This is a serious accusation. Shad threw down the gauntlet when she wrote, quote, "The voice of the fugitive is not the voice of the colored people in Canada. Few patronize it at all. Character, weight, ability are needed in a journal proclaiming itself the voice of the fugitives, in view of the glorious prospects before them as Her Majesty's freemen. But unfortunately, that paper gives feeble evidence of any one of the three." She signed the letter, the officers of the Windsor meeting. All the while this feud is going on, Mary Ann's situation with her school was dire. Her feud with the Bibbs had ruffled feathers within the AMA, and they decided not to renew her contract. Without funding, she couldn't support herself and keep the school open. On March 23, 1853, Mary Ann's school in Windsor closed due to lack of funding. The AMA had decided not to renew her contract because of religious reasons, but everyone knew the real reason why. The next day, after 6 months of covert preparation, the first issue of a brand new newspaper called the Provincial Freeman was published. Reverend Samuel Ward, Mary Ann Shad's ally and friend, was listed as editor, and Reverend Alexander MacArthur was listed as contributing editor. But this was only in name. By the time this issue came out, Ward was back at home in Toronto, and Reverend MacArthur had left Windsor for other job prospects. Mary Ann created this four-page sheet with the tagline, "Union is Strength." Unsurprisingly, the first issue of the Provincial Freeman took direct aim at the Refugee Home Society, their land buying practices, the agents, including Reverend Foote, and their fundraising techniques. But where the Freeman differed from the Voice of the Fugitive is that they published dissenting opinions, notably a letter from Reverend Foote. It was an expose on everything that Ward and Shad viewed as being wrong with the Refugee Home Society. But they provided both sides of the argument. They were embodying the fairness doctrine over 100 years before its conception, and this bolstered the Freeman's credibility. This issue was a prototype aimed at gauging interest in a new abolitionist publication in Canada. It was also a statement by Mary Ann Shad that she would not be bullied or driven out of the public arena by Bibb and others like him. And so Mary Ann Shad, after a year and a half of strife, public disagreements, the birth and loss of her school, had succeeded in creating the first issue of the newspaper, The Provincial Freeman. This officially made her the first independent Black woman editor of a newspaper in North America. But she still had a long way to go. She needed capital to start a weekly publication. She also needed a broader audience than the tiny settlement of Winston and Sandwich. She decided she needed to move the operation to Toronto. And that is where we will pick up with The Life of Mary Shad Carey, Part 2. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Feminist History. Please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts. I'd also like to give a special shout out to my friend Jasmine Brand, host of the Killing Nostalgia podcast, for her help with this episode. I could not have finished it without you. That's all for today. I'm your host, Maggie Coomer. I'll see you next time.